ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
By now, it's clear social media algorithms are not neutral. Our feeds are influencing the way we see the world. But just how aware of that influence are we? And what, if anything, can be done about it? I bring this up because new research about the social media platform X suggests that just a few weeks on what used to be Twitter can shift political attitudes, and the effects can last long after we log off. So is it really possible to use these sites at all without being affected by the system? My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Now joining me to unpack some of the biggest stories in tech right now and why they matter, we have longtime tech reporter and now a PhD research candidate with the ARC Centre of Excellence in Automated Decision Making and Society, Seamus Byrne. Welcome back to Download This Show.
Great to be back, Ray.
And we have senior lecturer in computer science at the University of the Sunshine Coast, Erica Mealy. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
We talk a lot about regulation of artificial intelligence, or lack thereof, and just this week, Professor Toby Walsh spoke at the National Press Club warning about the dangers of Australia's lack of AI guardrails. Now, more than a year of expert consultations and public funding went into building this national AI advisory body, only for it to be scrapped and replaced by the Australian AI Safety Institute. So what is actually happening here? Seamus, can you take us back a step? Why exactly is government regulation of artificial intelligence important in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, anywhere in the tech sector where new technologies are coming into interface with the general public, with business, with education, with sort of so many aspects of society, we want to make sure that these tools are ultimately serving us in the right ways and not just serving themselves. And I think we've had so many lessons over the past 20 years of what happens when you are playing catch up with modern technologies and then suddenly trying to respond to problems that we've seen come up over time.
$200,000 was spent on trying to bring this advisory board together and then it was just scrapped. Seamus, what did they scrap it in favour for?
Well, look, one of my favourite quotes here, because it just feels like such a classic yes minister kind of moment, is the idea that the rapidly evolving landscape required a rethink. It's like, yes, it's moving so quickly that we decided to do nothing rather than do the thing that was in motion. And that for me just feels like the most frustrating element here. We had a plan, we had a group of people who have expertise, and the fundamental idea of the advisory body was really just to be able to deliver advice to the Australian community, to businesses, to government, and actually help understand the best ways to try to engage with this. I feel like what we now have is this idea of an AI Safety Institute, but it was announced late last year. I think job applications closed in January. It's still yet to be put into effect specifically, but again, we could have had this other group in motion alongside actually establishing some kind of specific institute. They may have even been able to help advise on a great way to build something that was a little more robust than the simple advisory system that they were being brought into. So it just feels like, I mean, one of the fundamentals here is to remember that there is also a shift in the ministry. We had that window of about 8 months there between a new minister coming in, starting to reset priorities, and then by the end of the year deciding, let's start something different, but in the meantime, letting this other opportunity go.
So where does this leave us? How far away are we from having the kind of guardrails that Toby Walsh has warned about this week, Erica?
A long way, further than we were beforehand. And that's really my concern, is that there's clear evidence that there are some high-risk industries that we need to protect. And like Seamus was saying, I don't think putting our head in the sand is going to help us. And it does worry me that when the suggestion of guardrails, and these were voluntary guardrails that we started with, there was a lot of pushback from big business and big tech. I don't think we should be regulating based on who's being regulated saying, I don't want it. I think we should be regulating on the actual benefit of humanity and protecting our citizens, and not what's best for business, but what's best for our society as a whole. And the fact that as part of this piece, they've sort of now said that they're not looking at specific AI legislation, to me, that gives me concern for lots of things. We've gone from being a world leader in this space to, you know, trailing behind and a watch and see kind of space.
And we are used to regulation lagging behind technology, but this feels like it's more than just lagging. How do we inject a sense of urgency here, Seamus? How do we get this to speed up?
I mean, at least one very promising aspect of Toby Walsh's speech this past week was where he said that, well, if I'm not going to get to sit on this particular advisory body that would have been offering advice in private, then I'm going to start offering this advice in public. I think his comment was, I'm sure they will find this much more uncomfortable than I will. So really attempting to say, well, let's do this advice in a way that actually tries to place that urgency into why this matters and why we are now late rather than leading in this sort of respect. So I think that's a big one. You know, we have to look back at the Productivity Commission last year as well, where a lot of the advice is coming from tech industry and not from wider industries that are impacted by these. I think the way we get more urgency in here ultimately is to have, you know, more people who have the expertise sharing more advice in public and speaking to specific harms across different areas of society that these sorts of tools are not being managed for right now.
Thinking of the harms as well, misinformation and disinformation is something that always comes to mind when I think about the proliferation of particularly generative AI tools across the population and how they're being used. Could guardrails be established through this AI Safety Institute, behind closed doors, whatever's going on in there, that could help stop misinformation and disinformation, or is that more of a platform problem?
I think it's definitely a platform problem at this point. It's not clear how inside the Institute that might actually happen, because I think for me the main piece here for misinformation and disinformation is just education. We have to get out there. We have to, and it's great if we're going to do this publicly. Sign me up, Professor Walsh. I'll be there with you, and we'll champion this cause, because a lot of people don't understand how wrong these tools can be or how bad the advice can be. We've heard simple things like people going to ChatGPT to be able to get career advice, which sounds innocuous enough, but, you know, it was a young female software engineer, and ChatGPT told them to tell their boss they're good at baking and multitasking because that's what women are good at. Gosh. And you go, that's not okay. And so there's an incredible AI group down, it's actually a tool that's come out in New South Wales, Jamie.ai, which is seeking to, you know, change that narrative. But, you know, the fact that we didn't know that was going to be a problem until it was actually a problem. And it was because it was a software engineer that this happened to. She went, that's not good enough. Let's fix it. So, you know, being able to get out there and show these examples and help educate everybody, I think is really the number one thing that we have to do.
Well, hopefully they listen to download this show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. I'm joined by a longtime tech reporter and now PhD research candidate with the ARC Centre of Excellence in Automated Decision Making and Society. That's Seamus Byrne. And also Erica Mealy, who is a senior lecturer in computer science at the University of the Sunshine Coast. And there's been some new research come out into social media platform X that shows just a few weeks on the platform can shift political attitudes, but that these effects can also last long after you've logged off. So closing it and deleting it from your phone isn't going to be enough anymore. Generally speaking, Erica, how do social media algorithms work?
It's the same with our LLMs. It's garbage in and garbage out. That what you consume is what influences you. And we've seen this since the earliest days of social media. To keep you on the platform, they give you more of what you're interested in. And so if you have a slight interest in one area, they reinforce that so it becomes stronger and stronger. Of course, that's okay when we're talking about, you know, pugs wearing dinosaur costumes, but it's probably not okay if we're talking about political leanings, because you then take people who might have a quite moderate opinion of something, reinforce it with more and more extreme versions of that concept, and then we're really seeing this huge shift to the outer edges, both left and right. But the problem comes when the platform not balanced. So if it's regulated or run by someone who has a particular interest, then it can push people in a certain direction. And that's what we're seeing on a global scale and have been probably for the last maybe decade, I guess, across these platforms.
Seamus, as users, do we have any kind of transparency over different platforms' algorithms? Is this knowledge that is publicly available?
Very, very limited. So now and then we get promises from platforms that they're going to do more to make their algorithm more transparent, but it is incredibly rare that that's ever really happened. Yeah, certainly some of the newer platforms have tried to make this one of their features. So when it comes to platforms like Mastodon and Blue Sky, some of them have focused on this idea that they will primarily, by default, only give you the chronological feed, which is that traditional thing of it's just showing you the posts from people you follow in the order they were posted. And then they have options to let you design your own algorithm or to, you know, to use an algorithm someone else has used. So you can almost share different versions of the way in which you want to give things a bit more of a dynamic approach. So, you know, some of those sorts of newer platforms are trying to leverage this as a point of difference and as something for people who are looking to get out of the sorts of traditional systems. But there's definitely one area here as well where the degree to which these algorithms are tracking your activities in order to then feed you more is something also I think people don't quite grasp. It's not just about what you clicked on, but it is about things like how long did you slow down while scrolling past something? And I think that's one of those moments of capture here where you might slow down because something is shocking or something is beyond the pale in some way and you just can't even believe what it was you just saw. But that's taken as a signal that you want to see more of that kind of thing. So I think even if the transparency related to what are the kinds of things that are counted as points that they will use to influence the way in which you see things would, I think, in some ways at least help people understand the level to which these sorts of systems are actually monitoring and then shifting what we're seeing.
Yeah, it's kind of incredible when you start to think about it a little bit deeper. I'm curious about what specifically is happening to users over on X and what this study revealed. Erica?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting one. And honestly, I'm surprised it got past the ethics board because they have found long-ranging effects. So what they really looked at, so this has come out of Italy, and they did a randomized control experiment. So for all of those who've forgotten our high school science, me included, what we do there is we get a group of people and we randomly assign them either to one of two conditions. So you normally have a control group and then what you're actually trying to test. And so what they've done here is they've taken a large group of people on X and half of them randomly assigned just did the chronological feed. So as Seamus was explaining, it's just the things you're already interested in the order that they're coming in. The other half actually just let X rip and they just let X actually go the use the for you recommendations that we often see on these platforms. And what they found was there was an actual tangible movement in their political leanings towards the right across the entire set of the for you group. And that's because the recommendations were very heavily focused towards pro-Republican sort of American politics type of recommendations. But then the scary bit, like I said, with this ethics board is when these people then went back to a chronological feed, it didn't stop. They didn't move back to where they were originally. So it is having this longer term effect.
So ultimately, are we able to remain on platforms that do have algorithms that skew us one way or another without being influenced by them? Is that even possible, or is the only solution to just log off for the longest of times?
That's a really tough one. I think it depends how you engage with it. If you're doing the, you know, lying in bed trying to get to sleep, doom scrolling, then chances are you haven't got your critical mind engaged and you are ripe to be influenced. What were you going to say, Seamus?
Yeah, I think it's really that making that decision to be very active in the way that you set it up. And so that's things like setting up lists so that you do very specifically avoid the algorithmic feed, that you go there and you just look at a chronological feed of what are all the latest posts from people that I actually would be interested in knowing what their updates have been lately, because they're still there and I'm not, but at least that would be a way to catch up.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you. And I'm joined by Senior Lecturer in Computer Science at the University of the Sunshine Coast, Erica Mealy, and also a longtime tech reporter and now a PhD research candidate with the ARC Centre of Excellence in Automated Decision-Making and Society, Seamus Byrne. And it's a pretty scary reality that with a relatively cheap 3D printer and a quick web search, anyone could print their own unlicensed gun. These are weapons that have been described as untraceable, but in good news, there's now some research that's testing whether or not that is really true. So, how are people 3D printing guns without providing instructions? Who wants to take this one?
My media team are probably crying into their coffee at the moment. Like most 3D things, unfortunately, there is a lot of libraries online and, online and on the dark web. So we have this sort of public internet that we can search, which does have people actually, you know, curating websites and taking things down and these kinds of things. We then have the unregulated and less traceable dark web. So the dark web is where a lot of this stuff is found. And it's very common for 3D printing to have what we call a CAD design, so a computer-aided design file, so a CAD file that's available. And, you know, if you want to print that cute little 3D Pikachu, you go to the website, download it, put it onto your printer with the software, add the filament, which is what we print with, and then off we go. And so what's happening is that there are files available that people have made available, I would hazard probably on that dark web, and people are now able to produce these allegedly or to previously considered to be untraceable firearms, which of course is a huge problem. A lot of the work we do to protect ourselves is with, you know, metal detectors at the airports and such. And so these filaments aren't metallic, generally speaking. So it is quite a concerning problem that this has actually popped up.
It's one of those things that seems theoretical. It feels like, oh, 3D printers could print anything. It could even print guns. How common is this actually, Seamus? What do we know?
Yeah, there was one example in October where Border Force actually seized 281 3D printed guns. And I think there's an aspect to that sort of number where you think about the ease of production means that once someone has decided they want to explore this, then the speed at which they can make multiples is, you know, is only limited by the amount of filament they have available. So, you know, I think that's a really important part of this, is that if a criminal has access to this technology and it's very easily accessible, then that production process is easy enough. So how many are out there? We really don't know. But, you know, when there is a seizure in the hundreds, it speaks to the idea that there could be, you know, a lot of different groups out there who certainly had this capability or continue to have this capability and could stockpile these relatively quickly. So, you know, it's definitely something that I think it is important to find ways to fight back. You know, these are all printed in small parts as well. So it's, I think, very difficult to try to say, well, we could just somehow, you know, there's definitely discussions on you could maybe stop printers from, you know, if they recognize the parts, then they just wouldn't print the parts. But again, that they're able to be printed in, you know, in a whole sequence of different parts. In fact, that's just fundamental to it, that you then put them all together to create the gun after the fact. And so it would be very difficult to know every permutation of how it could be printed and stop that from happening. But being able to then start to enter this cool new phase where we might be able to know who printed it or how it was printed and the exact materials it was printed with does start to improve the ability to catch people doing it.
Yeah, what have we recently learned about how these guns can be traced?
So the really cool part is, and I love when I get to talk about some of my colleagues, because I work in science, technology and engineering. So we're actually leaning into our chemist friends now, and they're actually looking at with the polymers. So this is the type of plastic that's melted within the printer heads of these printers, that even if it's the same kind of polymer, you can actually tell based on what kind of other additives are listed and where it was made, perhaps what kind of environment it was in. Different printers will have different sort of heat signatures that might come through. So there's some really cool forensic work that they're actually starting to be able to do. And they can show now for a number of different polymers that they can use spectroscopy, if I could say that word properly, to be able to tell them apart. So they're using some really cool chemistry-based analysis to be able to say, yes, this is this type of printer, or this filament came from this manufacturer, which would then allow us to go into that, well, where was it sold? How has it gotten to? And also the other side of the coin allows us to go, all right, we've got this piece and we've seized this printing filament from someone. Can we say they are from the same role or the same manufacturer, so that we can actually then do those forensics on the sort of court and police side to be able to go, yes, we believe this came from there and this is how we actually established that.
Yeah, to be able to apply these sorts of ideas into this polymer space, like let's say somebody actually seized a 3D printer from a group where, you know, they were just involved with some other criminal activities, but there were no guns present, but they were able to take their 3D printer. And then months later, they find guns that were actually, you know, they can trace back that idea. They're going, yeah, we can now say those guns were printed on that printer and those people are now liable for more crimes. It's, I think, a really great way to be able to put those sort of supply chains together and actually make these people think twice about what they're doing.
I'd love to hear from each of you. Is there a little bit of tech that brought you some joy this week? More often than not, the news about technology can be a little dystopian these days. So it's nice to hear the good that tech is doing in the world. Would you like to share?
Yeah, I actually was having a bit of a chat. This sparked a whole day of joy in my team chat. I mean, my favourite one is I've got a thing called a Fit Bark, and it's like a Fitbit for my dog. And
oh,
so
what?
I can see when I'm at work, when he's actually getting up and getting moving, which is kind of fun. One of my colleagues, his young daughter has been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. And so he was actually sharing about the advances they're making, particularly with AI, with predictive analytics now. They can actually help predict insulin drops and spikes and can actually better control the insulin pumps. Eventually, they may even get to a fully artificial pancreas, which would just be such a massive, massive help for our diabetes sufferers in Australia. So that to me, I'm like, yeah, that would be incredible to be able to help that many people.
I think that wins for Joyful Tech, Erica, but we'll see what tech has brought Seamus joy this week.
Having now been into the second year of my PhD work, I've been struggling to really get a good knowledge management system going. And I feel like I've hit that point where I've found a piece of software called Capacities, which I think is really great, and it is free, so it is easy for anybody to try it. But the big thing that it's able to do is really capture all of the different things that I do with my research. You know, articles I read online. It can connect to my other favorite tool, Zotero, that manages all of the research papers that I read. And I can just constantly throw little ideas at it, but I can build links between all those ideas and, yeah, just surface clever connections in ways that I've never been able to do before with these sorts of tools. So Capacities, that's the one that I'm in love with right now.
Love it. Thanks, Seamus. And thank you so much for coming on Download This Show. Where can people find you and your work?
I exist mostly on Blue Sky these days and, you know, have done that thing where you can attach your own domain to it. So I have at seamusburn.me.
Erica, where can people find you and your work?
These days, unfortunately, a bit of LinkedIn. Well, not unfortunately. I do like how I'm connecting with my colleagues. But yeah, LinkedIn, or if you just search Erica Mealy and UniSC, we'll have some more fun things coming. So keep your eyes out for some cool tech things that we'll be doing.
Fantastic. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray.
And in some more tech news from the week that was, in case you missed it, China's DeepSeek is reportedly training its latest AI model on NVIDIA's top Blackwell chips, even though US export controls are supposed to prevent that from happening. Washington is allegedly watching closely with concerns about enforcement and the global AI arms race. Optus is set to detail changes to its investigation into last year's 000 outage, which left hundreds of emergency calls unanswered across four states for almost 14 hours. It has been linked to two deaths. An independent review found major gaps in the telco's escalation protocols, accountability and systems, and Optus says it's overhauling processes and staff to prevent this ever happening again. And in a push for Australia's space ambitions, a campaign has been launched urging the government to get astronaut and Australian of the Year Catherine Bennell-Pegg on a European Space Agency flight. It is understood that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has already received a formal offer from ESA. There's a 3-week deadline. Supporters say this is a rare chance to cement Australia's place in human spaceflight. And that's all for this week. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we do love hearing all your thoughts and your feedback. So send them over to Download This Show at abc.net.au, or you can slide into my DMs on Instagram at Ray Johnston. I am Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.